This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Boy, was I surprised when I found out that two people who I've interviewed, Mike White, who wrote the movie School of Rock, and his father Mel White, a Christian gay activist, were contestants on the reality show The Amazing Race.
Southern California, 0700 hours, the dawn of a new adventure. From this western coast of America, 11 teams will embark on a race around the world for $1 million.
So at each destination in this race around the world, the teams are required to perform physical feats ranging from paragliding to building a stone wall. The travel itself is an endurance test and a test of wits. So after Mike and Mel White were eliminated, we invited them to talk about their adventures and about their father-son relationship. As we'll hear later, when Mike was growing up, Mel attempted to overcome his homosexual feelings, trying every therapy available. And he also ghost wrote books by Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and Billy Graham. Now Mel is a retired minister in the Metropolitan Community Church, which has a large gay congregation. And he's the co-founder of the gay activist group Soul Force. Mike White wrote the films Chuck and Buck, Orange County, School of Rock, and wrote and directed Year of the Dog. He was also a writer on the TV series Freaks and Geeks. Mel White, Mike White, welcome to Fresh Air. I still can't believe you did The Amazing Race. I mean, I have to say, of the reality shows, this one's kind of like, if the myth of Sisyphus was made into a reality show, this would be it. Because you have to do these backbreaking things like carrying a traditional cheese rack up a slippery hill and then carrying 200 pounds of cheese wheels down the slippery hill. I know, like, on the first thing, the cheese wheel thing, Mel White, you said you had, like, a groin muscle injury. So what kind of injuries did you both sustain doing this?
Well, it happened before that, Dad. Tell him. I mean, he injured himself on the starting line.
You know, they lined us up and said, ready, get, set, go. And I did what a young person does. I took a big stride and I heard it pop. And so I limped all the rest of the way to our packs, got in the car, knew something was wrong and really discovered how wrong it was on Cheese Hill.
Gosh, I would have just given up, honestly.
Oh, you can't give up.
Well, there's so much. You have no idea. You have to fill out so much paperwork. And there's so much of a buildup to actually leaving that by the time you're on the race, you don't want to go because it would be the ultimate anticlimax. So we were going to do everything we could just to stay in it as long as we could.
What kind of paperwork do you have to fill out? I'm thinking like there must be so many. Go ahead.
They tested us psychologically and physically, and I flunked the MMPI.
That's the personality index test?
Right. Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, and the psychiatrist came in, and Michael was trying to stifle laughter, and she said, "You are the highest on the paranoia scale we've ever had."
Well, boy, you have reason to score high on the paranoia scale. I mean, you have to travel with bodyguards sometimes because you go to Christian churches, to fundamentalist churches and universities, and try to convince them that they should accept homosexuality as a normal part of life and stop working against it. So you have reason to be paranoid.
Well, that's why when the psychiatrist started going through the questions and I started answering them, I knew that that test was not for an activist.
Really? Well, in some ways, reality shows are designed to bring out the worst in people because you have to be brutally competitive, incredibly aggressive, and honest in the cruelest sense. Like, people are often encouraged to really say what they're feeling and not put any kind of politeness around it, which ends up sounding just like cruelty. So did you ever feel like you risked falling into that kind of behavior?
Michael said from the beginning, Dad, we're going to do this for fun, and I don't want you to go aggro on me. I had to look it up. Aggravated, don't get aggravated. And now and then he'd have to remind me that we're in it for the fun of it, but we never came close to having a fight. It was just too much fun to fight.
One of the things that surprised me watching you, Mike, was that, like in movies, and this first time I saw you in a film was in your movie Chuck and Buck, in which you're this kind of obsessive, like nerdy, backwards character who's never really emotionally grown up. And you know, the characters that you play are usually not exactly known for their, like, strength and physical prowess. But, like, you know, you take off your shirt in this, you got real muscles. Like, you are really physically fit. You know,
I told you, Michael.
I wasn't expecting that.
I told you
to look
good. He ran, you know, in his underwear.
I never thought I'd get a compliment on my musculature from Terry Gross.
That's right. And as your father just pointed out, you had to, like, run in your underwear for one of these, one of the parts of the series.
I think, yeah.
With heavy boots on, I might add.
Yeah. I don't know what to say. I'm just blushing. I have no comment. I have no response.
and
well,
Mel,
go ahead and blush.
Well, Mel, I'm wondering what it was like for you. I mean, like, you are 68. You're probably among the oldest contestants that they've had on. And to go through this incredibly physical experience, it's strenuous for the most physically fit person, for the youngest most physically fit person. Were there parts where you thought, like, no, maybe this wasn't the smartest idea?
No, I'm waiting for you to say something about my musculature.
Well, you look very fit.
You did great, Dad. You did great.
Yeah, I got a muscle somewhere. I just haven't seen it lately. I never felt really to the place we would give up. But when we were considering being eliminated on that last rung, I had to remind Michael to look sad.
So what was it like to watch yourselves do all the physical feats that you had to do, paragliding?
Terrible. I didn't know my wrinkles had wrinklets flopping in the breeze. I mean, I look as old as, you know, as Satan. God, I was just so depressed after I saw the first one. I'm not that old. There's some way they fixed that up on the camera. They've got wrinkle added or something. But
yeah,
first,
I
got
pale.
Used to it. And you're not that pale, that's right. Not that muscular either.
Oh, Dad. But no, it would. I mean, it's. I would get stressed before every episode. Just you know, because you don't know what they're gonna. You see it the same time America sees it. So I'm not used to that. And you know, you just you become self conscious. You know, it's like that part of it was not the appeal for me. I as much as I guess I've chosen an exhibitionist line of work, and to go on a reality show, you've got to be some sort of exhibitionist to want to do it. But that part of it is really not the pleasure. The pleasures were actually the doing of it, and then the unfolding of the show was kind of met with a little bit of dread for me.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Mike White and Mel White, and they were just father-son contestants on the reality show The Amazing Race. And they both have really interesting backgrounds. Mike is a screenwriter and director. He wrote the screenplays for School of Rock, Orange County, The Good Girl, Chuck and Buck, and he wrote and directed Year of the Dog. He's also appeared in a bunch of things, including a starring role on Chuck and Buck. Mel White is a gay activist, co-founder of the gay rights group Soul Force. He's a minister in the Metropolitan Community Church, which ministers to lesbian, bisexual, gay, and transgendered people. But before he came out, he was, you know, a Christian evangelical who was very close to a lot of the leadership, and he ghost wrote books for Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and Billy Graham. Now, I have interviewed you both separately, but never together. So there's so much I want to talk to you both about being, you know, a family. Mel White, let me start with a question for you. Now, you were closeted when you wrote the books for Falwell, Robertson, and Graham. And, you know, earlier in your life, you had tried therapies to overcome your homosexuality, including shock treatment and exorcism. Just to give us a sense of what you had to go through before just accepting the fact that you were gay, what was the exorcism like?
There was a Protestant charismatic group that just put their hands on me and prayed and prayed and prayed until I about went to sleep, hoping that the demon of homosexuality would be exorcised. But I went to a Catholic monastery that was known for its exorcisms, and when the abbot said, what demon do you want to have exorcised? I said, homosexuality. And after a long pause, he said, we can't help you here. I've always been grateful for that kind of honesty.
What was that supposed to mean, do you think?
Well,
from their point of view.
Yeah, it just meant that, you know, without gays, there wouldn't be a Catholic Church. I mean, cardinals, bishops, priests, and they know that gay men have served the church faithfully and with integrity for centuries. And I think they don't want to toss out that demon because that demon works for the church.
Maybe that's what they meant. Maybe they meant that it just hasn't, exorcisms haven't worked in this area.
Yeah. Anyway, it was really interesting to go through this. The first problem for me was not recognizing there was such a thing as gay or homosexual. For me, I was brought up thinking that that's both a sickness and a sin, sickness that needs to be cured and a sin that needs to be forgiven. So I said to Lila right at the beginning of our relationship,
this is your wife?
I said, you know, I'm struggling with same-sex attraction. And she simply said, well, what do you want to do about it? And I said, I want to be married. I want to have children. I want to have grandkids. I don't want to eat quiche. You know, the whole thing of what it means to be a man these days. And she said, well, then let's work on it. And so for the next 20 years, literally, we went to counselor after counselor, spent probably at least $100,000 on Christian counselors who said, if you'll just take more showers, colder showers, if you'll just pray more, if you'll just learn more Bible verses, that will take it away. And of course, that proved to be folly.
Including shock therapy.
Yeah, that was interesting. It wasn't the serious kind of shock therapy that they take you into a room and they fixed all these electrodes onto me and then showed me pictures of men and women. And when I saw a picture of a woman, I could turn off the power myself. And when I saw a picture of a man that was attracted to me, I had to turn up the power. So it was I handling all of those choices. And of course, I wanted desperately to not have this feeling anymore. So I put my hair stand on end for a couple times there.
Mike, I assume this is when you were growing up, that your father was ghostwriting books for Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, Billy Graham. Were they held up as ideals to you, people to be emulated and followed?
Not really. I grew up going to a secular private school. It was not I did not go to religious schools growing up, and had a lot of friends that were outside of the church and outside of that. And my parents, while my dad, you know, came from a very evangelical background, that was not the vibe around my house. I mean, we had a lot of theological discussions over dinner, and those were real and influenced me. But at the same time, it didn't have that kind of sort of fire and brimstone vibe over at our house. It was, my dad was, and my mom are both kind of open-minded and inclusive. And so some of the more kind of darker aspects to kind of that world, I don't think were really present in our household.
Mel White, how come you sent Mike to a secular school and not a Christian school?
One thing, it's kind of hard for me to clear up something, but my agent was Swifty Lazar. And he sold me to Simon Schuster to write these guys' biographies. And so many people picture me sitting at their table creating all of their anti-gay policies and so forth, whereas I just flew in, stayed time with them, recorded these interviews, and then wrote these biographies. So I would take home a lot of disgust. I mean, you know, when you get up close to Jerry Falwell, you can't help but like him, but you can't help but be disgusted by so many things he's saying. And I think the kids heard a lot of my reaction to these guys that would not set them up as models at all.
You know, but it's interesting. Even when you you came out and really were openly angry with and critical about the leaders, the Christian evangelical leaders, you retained your faith and you became a minister in the Metropolitan Community Church, which is, basically a gay church. So you never lost your faith, even though your life was no longer compatible with the faith.
I distinguish between spirituality and religion, and I really gave up on religion. And can hardly go to any of their churches or watch any of their programs. Fortunately, I go to First Christian in Lynchburg that's totally accepting. We had our first lesbian wedding there last week. So, I was really afraid that my kids would become like I was in terms of feeling ought about religion. But at the same time, it was my faith that got me through this. They taught me about a Jesus who loves anybody all the time, and I really believed in that, and that God had a smiling face to me most of the time. And so I don't know how I would have made it through all this struggle without thinking she still believes in me and still has work for me to do and is forgiving me even when I screw up. So I think my feelings about Jesus and God were the most important feelings I had to help me survive those days.
So you said you gave up on organized religion, but you're kind of back in the game. I mean, you're a minister now. You have a church. It's just a different kind.
Yeah, I'm not pastoring now. I'm retired, and I work full-time with Soul Force trying to help churches overcome their misinformation. Religion-based oppression is the problem for gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. It's religion that keeps homophobia alive, and so I'm still angry. It's very hard for me to participate in Soul Force actions now because we are committed to nonviolence. And there are moments that I would really, I get so angry that there's not a nonviolent streak in me at that moment. So I have to watch it. I'm really angry. I've received over 100,000 letters, Terry, after Stranger at the Gate. They're stored in huge crates.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they're stored in huge crates. And invariably, these young people are asking me, how can you be sure that God loves you if you're gay? You know, the question that the church should have answered a long time ago, the church has not answered. The church has said God doesn't love you as you are. And so you cannot know how many people I've seen suffer, how many kids I've buried who have killed themselves, how many kids I've visited in hospitals who tried to kill themselves. And it's all because the church has gotten this all wrong. And so, yeah, my anger is bubbling just below the surface right now.
Mike, can I ask you, when your father came out and, you know, made peace with the fact that he was gay and then even became a gay activist, did that have like a liberating effect on you to see like your father freed from the suffering that he experienced for so many years?
Definitely, I've felt that he was happier once he was able to be open and honest with everyone in his life about who he was, and at the same time, I were listening to him. He's still in the fight, you know, and he's not hiding anymore. But I think that he's committed to helping others that were in the same position that he was in, which is admirable. And at the same time, it's definitely taken a toll on him. It's not, you know, like he said at the beginning of the interview, you know, he failed his psychological test and they were questioning whether to let him go on The Amazing Race. And when you think of the people that go on these reality shows, like the fact that, you know, that my dad was on the border of whether they felt like it was appropriate for him to come, it's clear that, like, you know, always being in the front lines of this, you know, fight has had a huge impact on his psyche. And I think that, you know, one of the great unexpected fallouts of being on The Race is that he's getting so much feedback now for being, you know, for people seeing him as this, you know, compassionate and kind, funny guy that he is and proud father that he also is. And I think, you know, it's one of the first times in his life that I can recall where he isn't a divisive figure. Everybody just likes him, and they you know, he comes off sweet, and I think that's going to be a healing thing for him in a funny, unexpected way.
Mike, you said that your father's like still in the fight, and I'm wondering, like, do you feel in the fight at all? You've described yourself in publications. I've read that you were gay. I've read that you were bisexual. I'm not really sure how you describe yourself, but either way, there'd be reason to become an activist if you were so inclined. But it sounds like you don't see yourself as being in the fight, per se.
Well, I think that in the world that I live in, you know, I inhabit my chosen profession, there's ways that you, through representation and the kinds of stories you tell, that you, you know, try to make your own sense of what, you know, this is meaningful and this might affect change in some way and people's perceptions. And for me, that's where I've put my energy, is certainly from a professional point of view. And at the same time, no, I'm not. I don't consider myself an activist in the way that my dad is. But you know, life is long. Who knows what's in store?
And you're not a churchgoer, right?
No, I'm not a churchgoer.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mike White and his father, Mel White. You may have seen them work as a team on the CBS reality series, The Amazing Race. They were eliminated 2 Sundays ago. Mike White wrote the movies School of Rock, Chuck and Buck, Orange County, and Year of the Dog, and he wrote for the TV series Freaks and Geeks. His father, Mel, is a Christian gay activist and co-founder of Soul Force. Before he came out, when he was married and trying to overcome his homosexual feelings, he ghost-wrote books for Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and Billy Graham. Mel White, several of the evangelical leaders who you knew or have worked with have passed on. Jerry Falwell, D. James Kennedy.
Francis Schaeffer,
yeah, Tammy Faye Baker. So as the old leadership has left or is leaving the stage, there's new leadership coming up, probably most famous, Rick Warren. Do you see the new leadership changing things in terms of the evangelical community's leadership's position on homosexuality?
No, I don't. These new megachurch leaders, they have a kind of a patina of cordiality. They love you, but then they want you to change. So they're not like Jerry. You always knew where Jerry was, like a rattlesnake. But these guys are without rattles, but they're still snakes.
Now, Richard Cizik, who was the chief lobbyist for the National Association of Evangelicals, he was fired from that position after saying on our show that he supported civil unions. And I'm wondering, you know, I figured you were following that story. I wonder what your observations about that was.
That, you know, he was a very able guy, and he was fired because he said what he said, which I think supports what I'm saying, that basically the old guard dead has left a new guard in its place, and homosexuality is the only issue they can't deal with. The pastors say the people aren't ready. The people say the pastor isn't ready. Nobody's ready. And so kids by the millions keep falling through the holes. So, yeah, I don't have any respect for most of the megachurch leaders in terms of the stand they've taken. They'll work with people with AIDS in Namibia, but they won't let people with AIDS into their congregation. I mean, or work with those who have AIDS in their congregation. So, yeah, I'm very pessimistic, paranoid.
Mel, my understanding is that you moved to Lynchburg, Virginia, in part to be close to Jerry Falwell and to protest his church and to always try to goad him into changing and recognizing homosexuality as something that wasn't evil and that didn't need to be changed and to just accept it. When he died, what was your reaction to his death? I mean, you were almost... You were almost like a duo in that sense. Like you'd been through so many sparring matches together.
Yeah, yeah. Gary and I, my partner Gary Nixon, and I moved into a little apartment right across the street from his church, and then we'd invite people into our house after church and have cookies and so forth. And then we'd go into the church, and when he'd talk about gay people, we'd stand up and protest. He got so used to us standing up and protest, we became part of the liturgy. So, you know, it wasn't much of a protest. But we found in Lynchburg, which is, you know, a southern city, we found the kind of acceptance opening up little by little by little. And we are so pleased with what's happening in the churches of Lynchburg and the people of Lynchburg. So for me, yeah, we miss when Jerry died. What one regret I had is that he didn't have a chance to apologize for all the lies and the half-truth and the hyperboles he had used against us. But I had to say there's a lot of people who will miss him because he was a good pastor and he was a good provost, and his university is going strong and his church is going strong today.
Mike White, I have some questions for you. You're one of our many guests who has worked on Freaks and Geeks, the now cult status short-lived TV series set in high school. You know, because you got started on Freaks and Geeks early in your career, you met Seth Rogen, Judd Apatow, Jason Segel. And a while ago in New York Magazine, you had an interesting comment about Knocked Up, which starred Seth Rogen and was directed by Judd Apatow. And can I just quote that and get your reaction to this? You write, to me, I definitely stand on the corner of wanting to give voice to the people who are bullied and not the bully. And here's where comedy is catharsis for people who are picked on. There's a strain in Knocked Up where you sort of feel like something's changed a little bit. My sense of it is that because these guys are idiosyncratic looking, their perception is that they're still the underdogs. But there's something about the spirit of the thing that comes under the guise of comedy where it's weird. At some point it starts feeling like comedy of the bullies rather than the bullied. And do you think that's a strain that's classically run through a lot of teen and young adult films, and maybe even more so now? That,
yeah, I mean, to me, I mean, I got into some, you know, there were a lot of like follow-up conversations with Judd and those guys after that article ran, you know, I really respect Judd, and a lot of those movies are funny to me. But I also, you know, what I was trying to say was that, you know, you feel like, you know, some of it is about the comedy of people whose, you know, their scope of interest really ends in their like pleasure palace of, you know, video games and you know, genre movies and you know, it's like. So some of it you feel like it's like, I don't know, I guess I still feel a version of what I said, but that's not, you know, obviously there's a lot of more to it than that, and there's a lot more that I like about those movies and stuff, but yeah, I don't know. I don't want to get into trouble.
It sounds like you're backing off, Mike.
I'm just, you know, it's like, for me, it was like, it was definitely bad form for me to say something negative about a friend's movie, you know, a week before it came out. And had I been on the receiving end of that, I would have been as irritated as I'm sure Judd was. But I, you know, to me, it was more trying to talk about the strain of, you know, the kind of trend of comedy of late, which is, you know, where, you know, you feel like only certain kinds of characters populate those movies. And that part of it, I think, is, you know, something worth talking about, you know, and it's not a judgment necessarily, as just something to observe. And I think that, you know, it's one thing when the characters like in Freaks and Geeks are 12 years old and they're, you know, being bullied on the playground. But when the characters are now in their 20s and 30s and the psychology of it is still sort of in that same kind of, I don't know, it's the same kind of identities that you just wonder, you know, at what point do you get over, you know, being rejected by the hot girl when you're in junior high, and now it's time to, you know, to look beyond the sort of that kind of romantic storyline, I guess. I don't know. It's hard to explain. But it's you know, it's an interesting thing that those movies are really resonating right now with America, and they're funny, which is obviously the reason why they're successful. But I feel like there's someone else smarter than me should do a sort of, you know, an inquiry into what the catharsis is for the viewer to see these movies about these particular characters.
After having been on The Amazing Race, do you feel like you have a deeper understanding of why reality shows are so popular?
Well, I've always loved reality shows. I mean, certain ones, and I think that you know, just being on The Amazing Race has made me even more of a believer that real life lessons can be derived from reality shows. That there's some real truths to some of the lessons learned on reality shows. So, and I think that's part of why people tune in. It's not just for the humiliation or the ridiculousness or just, you know, people embarrassing themselves. It's that there's actual things that are sustaining and interesting, and that people that then kind of apply to their own personalities or their own lives.
I went thinking that most people go to reality shows like people go to attend racetracks because they like to see the wrecks. And I thought that if you're not nasty, you're not going to be popular on a reality show. And yet the kind of feedback we're getting and that CBS is getting about Mike and me, that we were having such a good time and it was such a relief from all the fighting. So I'm kind of changed about that. I think maybe you could be very popular on a reality show by just being nice.
Well, thanks to both of you so much for talking about your lives and your experiences on The Amazing Race. It was really fun to watch you both on that. Fun and surprising to see you there. So good luck with the work that you do. And thank you so much for talking together with us. Thank you.
Awesome.
Thanks,
Terry.
Mike White wrote the movies School of Rock, Orange County, Chuck and Buck, and Year of the Dog. His father, Mel White, co-founded Soul Force, whose goal is freedom from religious and political oppression for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. Coming up, Harvard psychologist Richard Weisbord talks about mistakes well-intentioned parents often make today. This is Fresh Air. Well-meaning parents today often unintentionally hurt their children by focusing too much on their children's happiness or achievements, according to my guest, Richard Weisbord. He's the author of the new book, The Parents We Mean to Be. He's a child and family psychologist on the faculty of Harvard. His earlier book, The Vulnerable Child, was named by the American School Board Journal as one of the top 10 education books of all time. Weisbord is the father of three children. Richard Weisbord, welcome to Fresh Air. Your book is about how well-intentioned adults can undermine children's moral and emotional development. What do we even mean when we say moral development?
Well, I think when we're talking about moral development, we're really talking about a number of moral capacities. We're talking about moral reasoning, you know, your ability to think through moral problems. We're talking about your sense of justice and, you know, developing a sense of fairness and justice, your sense of caring, your sense of responsibility. We're talking also about social and emotional capacities, you know, the capacity to help other people without patronizing them or to give feedback constructively. These day-to-day social skills that I think are very much a part of morality. So that's mainly the kinds of things that I'm talking about. I will just also say that I think as a culture, we're very focused on moral literacy, on whether or not kids know the values, on whether kids know what's right from wrong. But one of the things you see is by the time kids are 5 or 6 years old, they basically know the values. You know, they basically know what right and wrong is. And, you know, the bigger issue is really having those values be internalized, having those values be a part of the self, a part of a child's identity. So those values become more important than their moment-to-moment happiness at a given moment, or they're able to stand up for those values even if it has a cost to themselves. So, you know, I think our focus shouldn't be on moral literacy. I think it should be on this much deeper issue of moral identity.
Now, I hear a lot of parents say with pride that their child is like their best friend. You don't think that's really a very good thing. Why not?
Well, you know, on the whole, I think it's a very positive trend that parents want to be close to their kids. I mean, I think it's a wonderful trend and that parents are sharing more with their kids, they're listening to their kids, they're spending more time with their kids. But, you know, I'm also worried about it in some respects. It's, you know, for one thing, some parents, when they treat their kids as their best friends, become dependent on their kids and emotionally dependent on their kids. And it's much harder to discipline or to make demands or to create high moral expectations when you're dependent on your kids. We also need to let our kids separate from us. I mean, that's critical for them emotionally and morally to be able to separate from us. And when we're dependent on them, when they're our best friends, that's harder to do. And, you know, just I think the final thing I will say about it is that, you know, kids need to idealize us. And that's really the way in which they internalize our values. That's the way they adopt our values. And if we're their best friend, we're treating them like we're equals. And I think it can undermine that process of idealization.
Now a lot of the parents are the children of the baby boomers. And I'm wondering if you see any, I know that we're getting into generalization here, but if you see any generational differences between baby boom parents and the children of baby boom, at how they behave as parents?
You know, I think there are some differences between the baby boom generation and this generation of parents. I think there's, I mean, to some extent, this was certainly true of the baby boom generation of parents, but there is a very high focus among this generation of parents on their kids' moment-to-moment feelings, which I think is somewhat different. I mean, this is one of the things that you see on playgrounds a lot. You see parents who, you know, and I don't want to cartoon parents here because this certainly isn't true of all parents, but you see parents who are noting their kids' moods every 5 or 10 minutes, you know, saying, that must make you frustrated, or that must make you angry, or that must make you sad. And it's sort of like pulling a bandage up every 5 minutes to see if a wound is healing. And so I do think there is that kind of close monitoring of kids' feelings going on. And, you know, and in some respects, this is a good thing that parents are trying to help their kids articulate their feelings. But at the level it's going on, I think it can be irritating and stultifying and intrusive. And
why?
At this level?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it just sort of breaks down spontaneous play if parents are noting every 5 or 10 minutes how kids are feeling. And it's just very unrelaxing for kids. And, you know, I think also sometimes kids have to just work out these feelings on their own terms. So, you know, I'm all for parents helping kids express their feelings and doing it when these feelings are prolonged. I'm worried about some parents and the frequency of it.
When I was growing up, if you were away from home and away from your parents, you were out of reach for that amount of time. But now between cell phones and texting, parents and children can be in constant communication. And I wonder, you know, as a parent and as an observer and expert on parent-child relations, how do you think that's changing relationships?
Well, you know, I just think it depends. I just think the amount of contact you have with your kid is really not a good barometer of closeness or healthiness. That some kids really don't want much contact with their parents, and that can be absolutely fine. They want to be independent, and that's great. And other kids want a lot of contact, and they want a certain kind of intimacy, and that can be great as well. You know, I do worry some about parents micromanaging and hovering too much, and if being in cell phone contact is a way in which they're micromanaging and hovering, you know, that's not a good thing. I was visiting a college with my son, and, you know, parents were asking questions like, you know, during an admissions process. We were just doing a tour of the college, and parents were asking questions like, is there a rotating shower schedule, and does the washing machine take cards or coins? I mean, there's a level of micromanaging that goes on that gets pretty nutty sometimes. But again, I don't think frequency of contact is really the barometer of closeness.
Another thing you're worried about is parents who try to be an authority figure and a therapist to their child at the same time. What's the conflict there?
Well, you know, I think sometimes kids really need to work out their anger toward their parents on their own terms. And you know, if being a therapist means, you know, listening to your kid and sometimes helping your kid process their feelings, that's a great thing. But if we're talking about young kids and we're, you know, kids who are 4 or 5 or 6 years old and kids are getting angry at their parents and their parents are trying in the moment to help their kids process their feelings for them, I mean, sometimes that's very appropriate. But I think as a parent, you just have to be very careful that it's not about protecting you. It's not about securing you because you're worried about is you can't bear your child being angry at you because that you're doing it because you feel like this is a very important moment for kids to process their feelings, because kids, you know, will get angry at you sometimes, and they do have to work out their anger in their way.
And you think sometimes by playing the role of therapist, you're basically trying to explain, to rationalize your own treatment of the child and get them to agree that you were right. They
well,
shouldn't be angry at you.
Yeah, yeah. No, sometimes I think that's right. You're trying to get the child to agree they shouldn't be angry at you, or that you have or they have a good reason for being angry at you. And, you know, sometimes they're just angry. You know, they have to leave the park or they have to leave the pool and they're angry and they'll get over it and it doesn't really need to be discussed.
You know, you write in your book how parents are often obsessed with their children's happiness. But sometimes by elevating happiness as the most important thing, there are other really important values that get demoted in the process. Could you describe your concerns there?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's a concern about happiness and about self-esteem. And I just, you know, think in a day-to-day way, there are subtle ways in which we all prioritize our kids' happiness over their caring for others or their taking responsibility for others. And, you know, on playgrounds, you see parents who are very attuned to how their kids are doing moment to moment, but they're not helping their, you know, and again, not all parents, but they're not helping their kids, you know, reach out to a friendless kid on the playground, or they're letting their kid interrupt a group of older kids during a game. They're, you know, they're not helping their kids tune into other kids. And, you know, with my own kids, I feel like, you know, there have been times where I haven't insisted that they return phone calls from friends, or I've let them write off kids that were annoying. Or, you know, one of the examples, stories I talk about in the book is a couple who has, you know, they have a junior in high school, and she's thinking about whether or not she wants to quit the soccer team because she's not enjoying it anymore. And the mother says, you know, you should quit. It's not fun for you anymore. And the father says, but, you know, it's important for your college resume. But neither of them are thinking about the team and, you know, her obligations to the team. And so I just worry we're off whack with this, that we're out of balance. And our focus, you know, in these ways becomes very much on our individual kids' well-being and not on their sense of responsibility for others. And the irony is that, you know, I feel like if our kids are able to tune in and focus and care about other people, they're going to have better relationships their whole lives. They're going to be better parents. They're going to be better grandparents. They're going to be better friends to people. I mean, this is the foundation for lifelong happiness. So in the end, I think, you know, the focus on our individual kids' happiness is not only going to make them less moral, but it's going to make them less happy in the end.
For years, you've been writing about the overemphasis on self-esteem, and in your new book, you write that Americans have become intoxicated with the power of self-esteem. What are some of the ways that educators and parents have been using to try to build self-esteem that you're concerned about?
Well, one of them is praise. And you know, praise for real accomplishment is very important. Praise for effort, real effort, is very important. But again, I think that you see an excess of praise. I mean, you see a kind of steady stream of praise sometimes, and in schools, and you see it with parents and on playgrounds. You know, not long ago, I was watching a father and a son play catch with a ball, and every single time the kid threw the ball or caught the ball, the father praised it, and when the kid dropped the ball, he said, "Nice try." And there are sports programs that are advocating, you know, that you praise kids five times for every time you criticize them. And, you know, again, I think it's very important to praise kids. But, you know, one of the things that happens is I think at some point kids feel like this praise is meaningless, that it's vapid. I think sometimes when they're getting praised a lot, they can also feel patronized by it. Like, why do adults need to keep propping me up? When you're praising kids all the time, you're also judging them all the time. And, you know, so I think kids feel like their performance is at stake. And there's this research that says that, you know, kids who are feeling like their performance is at stake all the time and who are praised a lot can get very competitive and very threatened by other kids. And I just think it's important that we're mindful about why when we're praising a lot, about why we're doing it, and really think about it, you know, how our kids are responding, and think about, you know, is this about real accomplishment, and is this about real effort?
So your concern in part is that we're trying to build self-esteem by praise, but that's not necessarily going to build durable self-esteem. What do you think will?
I think the chain here is, I think we think that praise, among other things, will build self-esteem, and then self-esteem will build character. You know, I think self-esteem primarily comes from competence, you know, from being good at things at school, you know, having social competence. And I think it also comes from virtue, from acting virtuously, if that's something that's valued in your family or community. I think it comes from having good relationships, too, you know, close relationships in which you're really appreciated. So, you know, I think if we focus on helping kids develop those things, we're going to be in much better shape. You know, rather than happiness or self-esteem being the goal, one of the things I'm arguing in the book is that I think it makes sense for maturity to be the goal. And, you know, if you think of maturity as the ability to take other people's perspectives and to manage destructive feelings and to take criticism and to learn from it and to be self-observing, you know, I think those are the qualities in the end that, you know, are the basis for morality, but I also think they're the basis for good relationships and for lasting well-being and for competence.
Well, Richard Weisbord, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Richard Weisbord is the author of the new book, The Parents We Mean to Be. He's a child and family psychologist who teaches at Harvard. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menjivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. Our program was directed today by Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.